So thank you for Yvonne, your feedback on the tutorial, and thank everyone else who gave feedback. They're very useful. Thank you so much. Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of PSI works like this is that, you know, we make up stuff right before we go into the tutorial room. So things will be a bit rough around the edges. So your feedback helps improve the material for next year. Okay. And also helps me to learn. So yesterday, you know, about the tutorial, I wanted to give an example, but I just didn't get the time to get there. So I thought that today I'll start with the discussion of an example which illustrates some of the points that we talked about in the tutorial yesterday. So let's take and this is based on Jones, so you can read about it in that book if you want, but so let's consider the D3, the dihedral group of the regular triangle, the equilateral triangle. And it consists of the C3 or the rotation, the cyclic group C3, and three reflections B1, B2, and B3. And these are essentially reflection along the three medians. And so this group has four subgroups. One is C3, of course, which is the cyclic group, but it also has three C2s. And the three C2s are, if you take, say, the identity element and one of these reflections, then that's actually a C2, because if you do two reflections, you get back to the same point. So, and then you can, right. So for example, let's see what the coset looks like if we take, for example, our subgroup H to be, say, E, say, B1. Then, these are the cosets. Of course, there's the one that we get from the just by multiplying the identity. And then if I multiply by alpha, alpha is just a clockwise rotation by 120 degrees, we get alpha and alpha B1. If I multiply by alpha squared, we get alpha squared of B1. But if you think about it a little bit, if you apply B1, which is the reflection around, you know, this axis, and do a clockwise rotation by 120 degrees, that is the same thing as doing a reflection around the COZ axis. And similarly, if you do the reflection using B1 and do a two 120 degree rotations, then you get alpha squared B2. So these are our cosets for this particular subgroup H. Right. So now we may ask, is this a normal subgroup? So if it was, remember, for normal subgroup, you know, this condition needs to be satisfied, which we can write as this. What this means is that what we've been calling the right coset, the coset is actually, I think, the left coset. And so because we've been multiplying the H from the elements from the left, but we could have constructed right cosets as well. Yeah?
In our definition of H, is it EB1 or is it EBI?
EB1. So there's So there are three, you know, there are three possible C2 subgroups, depending on whether we choose B1, B2, or B3. I'm just choosing the one with B1. Okay. So H is a normal subgroup if the left coset is equal to the right coset. So to see, answer the question whether this subgroup, whether this is actually a normal subgroup. So okay, let me write more. For normal, for H to be a normal subgroup, the left coset has to be equal to the right coset. I think it's this is called right coset, left coset, but I might be wrong. Anyway, I think this is the left coset, and we can work out what the right coset is, and it's okay, right. Then basically, I actually haven't worked this out. So the first thing would be just same as this, and H of alpha would be alpha, say B1 alpha, and okay, what is B1 alpha? So I thought I worked it out, but okay, we can work this out. So I'm going to rotate this by clockwise by 120 degrees. So I need a little bit of board space. So. So if I do a rotation by, then what happens is this becomes A, and this becomes C, and this becomes B, and then what I do is I do a reflection around X, so around this axis, and then that goes to basically C, A and B, so the net effect is that I'm reflecting around the third axis, the B3, right? So I can write, sorry, this is right. So I can say this is going to be say alpha B3, right? So,
sorry.
Did you make a mistake?
I think it's B2.
It's B2.
Yeah, because you changed C and B.
Because this is my B2, right?
Yeah.
No, B2 is this way. It's along A.
Where A is.
In the end, we have exchanged B.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry. Yeah. So. What did I? A goes C, C goes B, and then I do a B1. So. Yeah, B2, you're right, sorry. Right, so. Exactly, so, sorry. And now we can work out the last one, but we actually don't have to because you know, we can see that, you know, this element is not equal to, this set is not equal to this set. So, you know, we verify that the left coset is not equal to the right coset, okay? So that means that this guy is not a normal subgroup. So H is not a normal subgroup. Okay, so what we can then do is that we can say, okay, what about C3? And by symmetry, you know, we don't expect any of the other H's to be normal. So we can say, is C3 a normal subgroup? And so we can.
I got lost.
Yeah.
B1 alpha. What was the answer at the end?
It was B2.
B2?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. So is C3 a normal subgroup? Well, what are the cosets? So, and if when the dust settles, you actually get this. And so this is these are the left cosets, and the right cosets are, so this is the left coset, say,
So in this case, our C3 is the G that we were pulling the little G's from.
C3 is this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that's where we get what we call G's, sort of. So we had GH, and then we did math.
No, this would be H. So what if, so basically, we take H to be C3. Because our big G is always D3.
Okay,
yeah, thank you. So, and the right cosets are, you know, this guy is gonna be the same. You know, when you multiply, you know, they kind of show up in different order, but you know, ordering is not important in a set. So yeah, these two sets are the same. So yes, C3 is a normal subgroup. So C3 is a normal subgroup. Right, so because C3 is a normal subgroup, we can go ahead and give that a group structure. And so the coset space D3 by C3 is a coset group. And what are the elements? So the elements are, of course, the cosets themselves. So the identity element is this guy. And you can verify that, okay, let me give you the other element. And the other element is this guy, is B1, B2, and B3. And then, you know, we defined the multiplication of between two cosets. So this would be, so for this, what you can do is that you can, if you want to, we've already kind of established here that the left coset is equal to the right coset. So we can actually, you know, see this. But if you want to really get nitty gritty, you know, you can actually pick some elements from H, some random element from H, and and see that this actually holds, okay? That when you multiply, you get back to the same, you know, the same coset. And E of B is going to give you EH, B1H, and again, oh, sorry. And then similarly, B of E is also going to give you B, and then B squared is going to give you E. So this has the multiplication table of C2, and therefore C2 is, okay, I'm gonna put the equivalence sign here, is D3 over C3.
Kibra?
Yeah?
Is there any geometric reason why the normal subgroups are called normal?
Oh, why they're called normal? I don't know. I mean, mathematicians, I don't know what the meaning of...
Geometric.
I don't know. There might be, I don't. But I'm sure there is. And probably when you go to a... I mean, why is it not an abnormal subgroup, right? maybe when you go to a continuous case, there could be a geometric, reason, but I'm not sure yet. All right, so that was a diversion to kind of complete what we started in the tutorial. So yesterday we were discussing rotation, so let me give you a brief recap of that before, so you are looking at rotations. Sometimes I forget how to spell. So, the way we described rotation initially was that we said, oh, we have some position vector represented by this column matrix, and we did some linear transformation to it, so it went to R prime. When it went to x prime, y prime, and z prime, and that was related to R by some 3x3 matrix, and this matrix we called O, and we said that we wanted the Euclidean norm to remain invariant, and that gave us a condition on what O would be, and the condition on O was that O transpose is equal to O inverse, right? And which also meant that O transpose O is 1. And if you took the determinant of this equation, we found that it said the determinant of O squared, because the transpose doesn't change the determinant, is equal to 1. And this equation had two solutions, which was determinant of O plus 1 and determinant of O minus 1. And what I told you was that when we pick the determinant equals to O plus 1, that's actually what we call rotation. And the rotation, a general rotation matrix O, has a form where we can write it as an exponential of I, 3 rotation parameters dotted with, 3x3 matrices, which are called the generators. So TAs were called generators. And because I chose the TAs to be Hermitian, because I'm a physicist, mathematicians sometimes choose them. Mathematicians don't tend to put I here. Then, of course, this would be, this would be, symmetric, anti-symmetric or something. Yeah, anti-symmetric. But it's still anti-symmetric. It's Hermitian. And you can, and you know, a general prescription when you can express a group element like this, a continuous group element, a general prescription for finding out the generators is this. You take, you know, you take the parameters and you take the derivative of your group element with, say, the parameter, and then you said that parameter equals to zero. So you can verify that this should give us I times the TA. So you can then divide by I. And for this particular group, the and this group is called the one with, is called SO3. The S stands for special. It is a special group. Whenever the determinant of a group of a set of matrices is set to one, mathematicians call it special. So special orthogonal group of three-dimensional special orthogonal group. That's what SO3 stands for. And I told you that, and you can verify that very easily, that these matrices satisfy an algebra called the Lie algebra, which has this form, and this is the epsilon is the Levi-Civita tensor, which has epsilon 1, 2, 3 is plus 1 or minus if it's, so any even permutation is plus, and odd permutation is minus. You've all seen this, right, this object. So this means E3, 2 is minus 1, and so on and so forth. And then I also told you about what happens when you take the determinant minus 1 elements. And they include the determinant minus one, part of the group itself does not form a group. And it consists of discrete elements like this. You can, of course, multiply one of these discrete elements to a continuous rotation, and it'll still have determinant minus one. So, and this particular element was called parity, and parity consists of a rotation and a reflection. And see that these kind of elements, they don't require any continuous parameter, right? I mean, reflection is a reflection. You don't reflect by 30 degrees, right? You reflect by a certain discrete amount, and that's it. So this part of the group doesn't add any new parameters to your group. It's still, the dimensionality of the group still remains the same. You know, when we get into the formal discussion of Lie algebra, I will tell you that these generators will form a manifold, and there's all kinds of geometry there. So this is a Blitz review. Okay, before I move on, I just want to mention that for small values of parameter, we can write this as I theta tau. By the way, can anyone tell me if O satisfies this condition, what does it tell us about T?
T is
symmetric or anti-symmetric? Shall we figure it out? Okay. Sorry?
You calculate.
Let's do it, yeah. Okay. So let's write this whole thing as M. Then I can write O as e to the power M, right? And now this is a power series, right? So if I say O transpose, it's just going to give you M transpose, right? Because in the power series, every matrix gets transposed, and they all commute with each other because of the same matrix, right? But whereas O inverse is going to be minus M, right? So if O transpose is equal to O inverse, that means that E M transpose is equal to E minus M, If I take the log of both sides, I have M transpose is, so M is an anti-symmetric matrix because we are not doing any complex conjugation, so the I is just, is not playing a role here, right? So that means T is also anti-symmetric.
So there's a problem in the TA dagger equals TH, to TA equals minus TA dagger, right?
No, so they're anti-symmetric, but they're imaginary, pure imaginary, right? So when you, so, okay.
So dagger is not, okay.
This is,
yeah.
Right? And when you take the complex of that, you the eyes, yeah. Okay, all right, cool. All right, let's move on. So before we move on, let's just quickly mention two-dimensional rotations, which is a subgroup. So rotations in a plane form a group called SO2, and essentially so two-dimensional rotations have this form, as you probably all know. And there's only one parameter here, one rotation. So it's a one-dimensional group, continuous group. And SO2 is actually, it's an abelian group. And dimension of SO2 is 1. And the angle, the value, it takes value from 0 to 2 pi. So this means that as a manifold, SO2 is the same thing as a circle. Right? Meaning that, you know, because the angle just takes value on a circle, right? SO2 is also isomorphic to the group of complex phases of unit 1. Or I guess phase does mean unit 1. SO2 is isomorphic to, say, complex phases to the group of complex phases. And this group is given by, if you have, this is the multiplication law. And so this group is known as U1. So sometimes you will see SO2 is isomorphic to U1. U1 means, well, we'll get to the definition of a unitary group eventually, and U1 is 1 by 1. It's just a phase. All right, so before we get into formal stuff about representation theory, there's a few more one more concept that I want to introduce. Actually, a few more concepts. And the first one is conjugacy class. Um, Usually the idea of a conjugacy cluster is introduced in the context of discrete group, but I'm going to use continuous group. So consider two rotations. So consider two rotations by the same angle. Suppose rotation by 30 degrees, but one of the rotation is around the x-axis, another rotation is around the z-axis. Now, in some sense, these two rotations, if you have a physical system, what you call the x-axis and what you call the z-axis is largely arbitrary, right? I mean, you can just relabel, you can just rotate your reference frame, and x-axis becomes z-axis, right? So in some sense, you know, the rotation around the x-axis by 30 degrees and the rotation around the z-axis by 30 degrees are equivalent. So there should be some equivalence relationship between them. So this is similar to, suppose you're working on with some permutation group, say P4, and you have four objects, and then you decide that, oh, I'm no longer going to call the object, I'm going to switch the labels of the objects in place one and two, right? So physically, you know, what you're doing, you're just relabeling it, right? But then the group elements will look different because, you know, the labels have shifted. So what I'm trying to say is that the thing that I'm going to describe now also has an analog in, that definition also carries over to in discrete cases. So the definition is two elements of conjugate elements so two elements, say A and B, of a group G are conjugate to each other. We have space. Are conjugate to each other if there exists some element say G, which is not necessarily unique such that A is given a G inverse. And G is called the conjugating element . So we write A is equivalent to B because let's call this something, because star is an equivalence relationship. So you can verify that. Okay. And you can, to verify, yeah, that's easy to verify. So now let's go back our rotation example and see how this is implemented. So let's, you know, consider rotation around the x-axis. So let's call it, okay. I have a bad habit of using R for rotation and O as well. So let's keep O. So O of I by an angle theta acting on R gives me some R prime. So this rotation by an angle theta is conjugate to rotation by angle theta around any other axis. That's a claim. But you know, just for the sake of argument, you know, let's definiteness, let's consider a rotation around y-axis. So what I'm trying to say is that okay, so this is my reference frame, and this is x, and I'm doing some rotation around this, and this is y, and I want to do the same rotation around y-axis. I'm not rotating this, I'm just saying this is how I'm rotating. So now notice that, you know, we take, it takes an, like a rotation of 90 degrees around z axis to take x to y, right? So if we now say rotate r by around the z axis by 90 degrees, and I rotate r prime also around the z axis by 90 degrees, then the new vectors, which would be, say, I don't know, you want to call them, say, r tilde and r tilde prime, you know, they would now be related by the same rotation, but say, but the rotation will be now around the y-axis, right? Does that make sense?
Can you explain that again?
Yeah. Right, so my claim is that, so this is a rotation around the x-axis, and what I'm, my claim is that, you know, there should be you know, a rotation around any other axis is going to be conjugate to this. To see that, what we have to do is that we have to find the transformation that takes us from x-axis to this other axis. And for definiteness, what I'm saying is that let's consider the second set of second rotation to be around the y-axis. So now we have to find the transformation that takes the x-axis to the y-axis. What is that transformation? That transformation is a rotation around z-axis by 90 degrees. Okay? Basically, our, you know, this guy will be taken to, man, some habits just die hard. By a rotation by 90 degrees to this guy, and this thing will be, you know, is by this guy. But of course, like, these two things are related by a rotation around the y-axis. Right? This is basically what I've been talking about, is that I'm basically taking the whole system and rotating it, you know, in such a way that the rotation that was happening around x-axis is now happening around y-axis. Okay. Right, and so now we can multiply this thing by the same matrix. If you multiply and over here, what I'm going to do is that I'm going to insert an inverse of this matrix. And because I'm doing a rotation in a, you know, in a plane, because this is just rotation around one axis, right? The inverse transformation is just this thing, is by, and then I again have to insert. So this whole thing is one, and
I think we get what we wanted just by multiplying to the left, okay, with minus pi halves.
Sorry?
That I think that we get what we want by just multiplying.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
Minus pi halves.
Yeah, you're right. I made a mistake in my calculation, actually. You're right, yeah. So, yeah. So we actually, yeah, you're right. So this is, I multiply by minus pi by 2, and right. This, and there is O of k pi by 2, and over here, we have basically our prime. And over here we have R. And now, what you want to verify is that if you just plug this into Mathematica, or you know, do it calculation by hand, this is going to be the same thing as OX of theta. Okay. So in other words.
I.
That's as Francois sometimes says. Yeah, it's notation is no, it's not even locally consistent. So basically, what we have shown is O I of theta is given by some element, say g, times O I hat. So I'm wearing a hat. There's no hat here. Is g of j. That's where the hat should be. Right. So that's where the hat should be. Okay. So in other words, all rotations by the same angle, they are conjugate elements, and they form an equivalence class. Okay. And you might say, what is the, you know, what is the usefulness of conjugate elements? And you know, this thing, every element in which are related by this relationship, they are said to be in the same same conjugacy class. You might say, what is the usefulness of this? When we get to representation theory, we will see that, you know, a group can have different kinds of representations, and you know, it's really by looking at the conjugacy class of those representations that we can tell one representation from another representation. Okay, so we'll come back to this idea. Sorry, I don't think that was very well explained, but do you have any questions? I mean the geometrical idea is pretty simple here, and you know, I just wanted to give you a geometrical picture behind the notion of conjugacy class. All right. All right. The next on our list is the definition of a simple group. Of course. So the so the identity element E and G are, you know, automatically normal subgroups. So if E and G are the only normal subgroups, of G, then we say that G is a simple group. The simple group will have some analog in Lie algebras, and that's why it's an important concept. Often we have, in physics, you come across a system on which more than one group acts, but they act almost independently of each other. So for that, you know, it's useful to have the definition of a direct product of groups. So a group, say G, is, you know, said to be the direct product of two subgroups A and B if one all elements of A commute with all elements of B, and number two is so every element of G can be written in a unique way as G is AB with A in A and B in B. So a couple of comments are in order. So consider two elements, consider G1 and G2. So G1 and G2 are basically A1, B1, A2, B2. And because they all commute, you can write this as A1, A2, B1, B2. So multiplying elements of G. So this means that multiplying elements of G is like multiplying elements of A and B separately. I didn't think I would make it in that. Another important comment is about both A and B are normal subgroups, and anyway, so. So the second comment is, let's number our comments. Number one. So both A and B are normal subgroups. And therefore, if I take the quotient of G by A, we get B. And if I get the quotient, we get A. So this is, it's kind of probably an intuitive result, but it's good to point this out. So basically this follows from the theorem that we proved yesterday. Because A and B, if you remember, we looked at normal subgroups and we saw, we basically said that, basically what we said is that if you have a normal subgroup, then the coset space can be given a group structure, right? And here, that coset space happens to be the other group, right? And similarly here. It's kind of a little bit of a trivial, not a trivial, but intuitively clear result, but I think it's worth pointing out. And this is something that crops up a lot in physics. In physics, a lot of times you will see, oh, our, you know, this this theory has a symmetry SU2 left cross SU2 right. You know, and you know, we quotient by this and we get that, you know, and people will like throw out those kind of, you know, and they quotient by say one of these things and you get the other one. So I just wanted to point out, you know, this is, you know, that you will come across this again, probably in physics. So before we get, before I get to formal representation theory, which I will get on Monday probably, I want to discuss some of the other important continuous groups. Okay, we have only seen SO3 and briefly SO2. So a very, very important continuous group for physicists is the Lorentz group. So so the Lorentz transformations of special relativity, so the Lorentz boosts and rotations, the Lorentz transformations of special relativity. You know, they also form a group, and how can we see that? So we take for us unit in which the speed of light is one. And then if you remember your special relativity, there's this thing called the interval. And depending on the textbook you read, there was a minus or a plus sign here, but there's a relative sign between the space part and the time part. So the interval is this difference between two events. Events are points in space-time. So in special relativity, you know, this thing can be, it can be either be greater than zero, it can be equal to zero, or it can be less than zero, right? So it can be positive, zero, or negative. So let me kind of introduce some notation, and this is important notation. For those who haven't seen this before, so I will write by x mu I. Or I will write this, you know, space-time position vector, or the space-time coordinate. I think it's better to call it coordinate. So coordinate on space-time, because when you actually go to general relativity, you know, in when we're dealing with flat space-time and in special relativity, and we're using Cartesian coordinate system, this thing can be thought of as a vector, a position vector in four-dimensional space-time. But when we go to GR, the notion of a position vector doesn't make sense anymore. And if you haven't, the way to think about it is that, you know, a position vector on a flat piece of paper makes sense, but the position vector on a globe, no, doesn't make so sense, much sense, right? Yeah.
Where are there number indices in the T, X, Y, and Z coordinates there?
Okay, that's just the label for the point. So I'm, because I have two events here, one and two.
Right, but the upper indices, like, I thought this was the lower one. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. So this means that. So you know, this means that x I zero is t, x I three is say z, right? Great. So we can choose our coordinate system such that you know, x two mu is zero, and then I can drop this index because now we have only one event. Well, we still have two events. So, okay, let's call what I mean is this, and then I can call x1 of mu. I can just introduce a notation where I just drop this one. Then this thing takes the following form. Then the interval, it's called the invariant interval. And some people have argued that Einstein's theory of relativity should not have been called the theory of relativity, but the theory of invariance, which is the opposite of relativity. And social scientists say that because it has been such a huge, it has had a huge impact on human culture. And you know, so if it were called theory of invariance, it probably would have had a more positive impact on human culture. But anyway, so if I make those choices, my delta S squared can be written as x mu x nu eta mu nu. Okay. And here I'm using the Einstein summation convention. So the Einstein summation convention, which Einstein called the most useful invention of his life, not the most important, but the most useful, you know, is that whenever an index is repeated, there's an implicit sum. So what this means is there's a sum over mu and nu, and the both sums go from 0 to 3. Right? This is what it means. And where eta has this form, so this is the convention I like. Some people use the mostly minus convention. And eta mu nu, it's called the metric tensor. Why it's a tensor, what are its tensorial properties? David will talk about that next week or in his relativity course. But it's called a metric tensor. So is this clear that this, you know, that equation, the minus sign just gives me minus t squared, and these plus signs give me x squared plus y squared plus z squared. And so in matrix language, I can write this equation as delta S squared x tau, the x transpose eta x. Right, yeah. So now if I make a linear transformation, also known as Lorentz transformation, not yet. So I'm making a linear transformation where x is mu is going to x prime of mu, and I have some 4x4 matrix whose elements are given by mu and nu. So lambda is a 4x4 matrix. Then these transformations are Lorentz transformations. So this is Lorentz if x prime, if that thing remains invariant, which means x prime mu eta mu nu, x prime nu is equal to x, x mu eta mu nu x nu. Okay. Of course, I'm writing this in terms of matrix elements, so things can move around, but I'm writing it in a suggestive form. So what does this mean? This means that because it's a Lorentz transformation, this guy is lambda mu sigma x sigma. So this is just this guy. And then I have eta of mu nu. And then for here, I have lambda nu rho x of rho. And this is equal to x mu eta mu nu, right? So this is, if this is to hold for arbitrary x's, then it must be that the lambda matrices must satisfy, you know, this condition. So here I can just make life easier for you and relabel these as sigma nu rho, because we are summing over indices. It doesn't matter what symbol we use. It's called a dummy index, okay? So this is what the lambda matrices have to satisfy. In matrix language, this means lambda transpose eta lambda has to be this. So this equation is very similar to the equation that we found for the rotation. So for the rotation, it was O orthogonal transpose some identity matrix, which I didn't write back then. So in some sense, the identity matrix is the metric of three-dimensional Euclidean space. So matrix, so you can verify that this actually forms a group, the matrices which satisfy this. And that group is called O1, 3. Or it's an orthogonal group of orthogonal matrices with 4 by 4 matrices, but it preserves this weird identity, this metric, which has 1 minus sign and 3 plus signs. That is where the 1, 3 comes in. Okay? And this is the, so this preserves the eta mu nu, right? Okay. So this is the Lorentz group. And the Lorentz group, you know, it defines a new kind of geometry. You know, it defines a new kind of geometry, which is very different and distinct from Euclidean geometry. And Einstein's teacher, Minkowski, formalized this geometry, and in his honor, Einstein calls this the, named this the Minkowski space. Is too far away. So some questions now, some comments. What is the dimension of the Lorentz group? Let's figure that out. I mean, So, in other words, what, you know, what's the number of independent parameters? What is the dimension of 01, 3? So let's look at that equation, the defining equation. Now, lambda is a 4x4 matrix, right? And it has to be real. Why is it real?
Because it is only the sign of the interval. So
right. Yeah, exactly. So, so this has 16 real components, right? Real components, or yeah. Initially, and then if you look at these conditions, there are four diagonals. They give you four real conditions, and there's on the upper triangle there are six entries, and the lower there are six entries. But if you write out this equation in terms of these, you know, mu and nu, and take the transpose of this, you get the same equation. So the conditions you get from the six upper ones are exactly the condition you get from the lower upper ones. So you get 4 plus 6, so which is 10 conditions, right? So as a result, you know, you have 16 minus 10 is 6 real independent parameters. And we know from physics that three of these are rotations. And three of them, these are the boosts. Okay. And so basically, let me write this. The dimension of 01, 3 is 6. So there is a subgroup called SO1, 3, which are the rotations of the boost. The other, you know, there are elements in the Lorentz group which, you know, corresponds to parity. So they're, you know, there are elements like this, 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1. This is the parity. And there's also time reversal. But the boosts and the rotations actually form this. It's actually not the whole SO1, 3. It's called, you know, I think the lambda 0, 0 component has to be positive. It's called the orthochronous Lorentz group. But, you know, you'll get into, you know, when you come to quantum field theory, you know, Dan and Gong will discuss more about, you know, the details of the Lorentz group. Okay, so this is a super important group. And there are a couple of more groups that are also important that I want to talk about. The next one is kind of trivial, but important nonetheless. Let's go there. So the translation group so if I take a space-time event And if I take the whole of space-time and add some constant to it, then that also forms a group. And so this is an abelian group. And this is a group you have seen before. It's essentially four copies of R. So this is called R4. So the direct product of four copies of four R's. And then lastly, the Poincaré group. I think there's a, the Poincaré group. Poincaré was an interesting man. He was a physicist, a mathematician, and a philosopher. And his ambition was to be a philosopher in life, but he's remembered as a mathematician and a physicist, a great mathematician and a great, and a great physicist, For example, he discovered chaos, right? In the solar system, three-body problem and stuff like that. And, Poincaré recurrence comes from there. And, he has conjecture, which was one of the Poincaré conjecture was proved recently, and there was a Fields Medal given, and the Fields Medal was turned down by the person who received it because he had lost his faith in the mathematics community. But anyway, so. Okay, so what is a Poincaré group? It's a group that consists both the Lorentz group and the translation group. So in other words, it's a group of symmetries of four-dimensional Minkowski space-time. So it consists of includes the Lorentz group and the translation group. As you all know from your physics, that translations and the Lorentz group don't really commute. They have a weird relationship. If the thing that you're doing is general enough. So the multiplication law for the Poincaré group in terms of the elements of the translation group and the Lorentz group is a bit weird. And I will write it down, and you can verify that by just playing around with it. So suppose I take some AI to be in R4. So I'm suppressing this mu index, okay? But there is an index. So AI is some translation. A set of translation, and we have some Lorentz transformation. Again, I'm suppressing the mu nu index. It's some rotational boost. Then the composition law is given by. I once worked this out. You only have to work this out once in your life to verify it exists, it works, and then not worry about it. So the first one, okay. So the way I'm writing an element of the Poincaré group is the first entry is a translation and the second entry is a, you know, is a rotation. So this is basically how, if you do two consecutive, you know, transformations of the Poincaré group, this is how they combine. And this structure is known as the semi-direct product. So the Poincaré group is a semi-direct product of the Lorentz group and the translation group. All right, so I have 7 minutes left. Let me just give a, like a, it's just in time for the blurb about representation theory. Yay. Okay. So our next topic, we are getting more serious now, is representation theory. Now this is a vast subject. So in physics, you know, we are not really interested in groups as abstract entities, right? I mean, groups live in some Platonic cloud, right? We are more interested in you know, how they act on physical systems. In other words, so a lot of times in physics, and more so in quantum mechanics, you know, the state of a system is represented by some vector in some vector space. You know? Even in classical physics, you know, that may be true. You know? Or it can be a point in phase space or something like this, right? It could be an n-tuple. So, so basically, when we are talking about symmetry transformations on physical systems, we are talking about how talking about is linear transformations on these vectors. So, so vectors correspond to some state of a system, and some linear transformations these are the, say, the symmetry transformations, or I should say linear operator. So linear operators acting on the vectors give us some symmetry transformations acting on the states. This is a very rough thing. So what we're interested in is how these linear operators are represented on this vector space, right? So, so the linear operators are represented sometimes by, say linear differential operators. So for example, in quantum mechanics, the C star algebra and all that kind of stuff. And then they're also represented by some finite dimensional, sometimes even infinite dimensional matrices. So here we will be interested in we are interested in groups as represented by matrices, finite dimensional matrices. In groups or group as represented by, say, finite dimensional matrices. Okay. For this, we will need to formalize this definition. We will need, you know, a group of matrices called SLNC, which is the group of n by n matrices with complex entries whose determinant is non-zero. And I will start with that next time. What is the definition?
If it is zero, what happens?
Because we are going to use multiplication as the group multiplication law, the inverse cannot be defined. Because for inverse to be defined, you have to have. But this is a very, you know, this condition of having like determined non-zero doesn't really cut down any of the number of parameters because it's an inequality. Well, it's not an inequality, but